This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry reporting today from Southern Africa. Thanks for listening. Todd Zwillick, our Washington correspondent, is hosting with me and following the news at Takeaway headquarters in New York City. Hey, Todd.
Hey, John. Back here in New York, we'll be looking at the impact of yesterday's massive protests in Egypt and President Morsi's response to those protests, and pay for the country's top CEOs and how those bonus packages are only getting bigger and bigger. And a look ahead to the challenging nature of warfare. We'll talk with the head of the 82nd Airborne Division, the paratroopers, of their future missions as the war in Afghanistan winds down. And we reflect back on the 150th anniversary of the battle at Gettysburg. Back to you, John.
First of all, a big welcome to all of our new listeners from around the country on this July 1st, Independence Week. Hello to San Francisco, Minnesota, Tampa, Hawaii, and San Antonio. And that's just the beginning of all the hellos this summer. I'm speaking to you from the Atlantic coast on the western edge of Namibia. And it's a sign that history, news, world events can erupt just about anywhere. Little did I expect that when I planned a vacation with my family to Southern Africa last year, that this region would become the scene of a remarkable passing of the torch of history. And with little more than a microphone and a few batteries in a bag with me, I can start a conversation about how what is happening here resonates around the world.
If and when he passes from this place, one thing I think we'll all know is that his legacy is one that will linger on throughout the ages.
Mandela and Obama, a 20th century story intersecting with a 21st century story. From New York to London to Johannesburg, the signs were everywhere. My plane from London was loaded with network anchors and camera people coming for the Mandela story. Airplane seats hard to come by. We nearly got bumped off the plane in New York. The Johannesburg airport full of black equipment cases, the tabloid papers full of headlines about the vultures of the media descending on Pretoria for the end of Mandela, a paper declared, while another told the story of one of Mandela's reported children snubbed by Klan elders who prevented a visit at Mandela's hospital bedside. Madiba child snubbed, the headline screamed, using Mandela's affectionate Klan name. Airline employees in Johannesburg pointed out that flight crews were being told to stay out of the center city as preparations for Mandela's passing were underway. 10 days of mourning planned. Don't go near the place, one said. President Obama is also around, I mentioned, and some of the Africans nearby said, "That's right, he's here. I forgot," said a young anthropology student on his way to Botswana. Nobody's even talking about him. Of course, visibility is high where Obama did visit. The visit to Robben Island, site of Nelson Mandela's 27-year imprisonment, the president's call to Mandela's wife, the visit with Mandela's family, all meaningful, as was the announcement of an investment to develop African leaders. But it was hard not to notice the lines of young people waiting to get their pictures taken next to a painted statue of Nelson Mandela in the Johannesburg airport. Venezuelans, Americans, and a team of young football players from Angola all snapping their pictures with a fake Mandela on their way home. Obama is not the story here right now. But perhaps the collision of these two symbols is the story. Mandela of the 20th century, representing its bitter struggles and heroic triumphs, is colliding with the 21st century symbol, Barack Obama, a symbol heavy with questions and anxiety about the future.
He comes here for trade and economic development, but he's not coming for that. He's coming here to plunder Africa. And South Africa.
We're upset about the use of drone warfare and also the maltreatment of the whistleblowers.
We pray for you. We want you to be known as having brought peace to the world.
So long as parts of Africa continue to be ravaged by war and mayhem, opportunity and democracy cannot take root.
Is that identity strong and heroic under the leadership of a president who symbolizes how much America has delivered on its promises of freedom and equality? Or is it more uncertain and deceptive under a presidency that of late has come to symbolize how much America is in economic and political decline, grappling with issues of freedom, government control, the highest incarceration rate in the world, a milestone ironically once held by the nation of South Africa? The people here in the African nations he is visiting sense all this and are full of questions about what Obama represents today. We'll explore some of those questions later this week. I am in Namibia right now, which I imagined would be far, far away from all this when I booked a family holiday 7 months ago. Today, all of Africa is the site of this grand and puzzling collision of history. I'm sure Mandela would love the irony of it all. And that's the thing about the news business. You can never really get away, right? That often happens to me. You try and drop out of sight and boom, history just shows up on your doorstep. That's my takeaway on this Monday. I'm sure you all have stories like that about your own vacations. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE with a story or go to thetakeaway.org.
This is Todd Zwillick. On the anniversary of the election of Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi, standing in the same square where the public cheered his election just 1 year ago, hundreds of thousands gathered in Tahrir Square and millions across the country in Egypt demanding Morsi's resignation. Now, the protesters, angry with the Muslim Brotherhood, stormed into their headquarters, clashed with members trapped inside that building. Meanwhile, protesters threw Molotov cocktails and stones at the building and set fire to the logo on top of the headquarters. Ahead of the violent protest this weekend, the highest religious authority in Egypt, the Al-Azhar Institute, warned that the country is at risk of sliding into civil war, and Mohamed Morsi himself seemed to be trying to make amends. In a widely televised speech on Wednesday, marking his first year in office, he admitted to making mistakes. Listen.
I did my best with the loyal people of this nation to evaluate the situation. I was right in some cases and wrong in others.
Joining us now to discuss the protests and the future stability or instability of Egypt is Michael Wahid Hanna, a senior fellow at the Century Foundation. Hi, Michael.
Hi, good to be with you.
Joining me in studio and reporting from Cairo, Dalia Siada, Egyptian blogger and activist. Dalia, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
Let me start with you, Dalia, since you're on the ground there in Cairo. Give us a sense of what unfolded over the weekend. What's happening on the ground in the square and across Cairo?
I think yesterday was a very special day that not only Egyptians, but the whole world will remember forever. People got out in very large numbers, and we were asking for one specific demand, which is immediate resignation of the president and setting a date for a new presidential elections.
If Mohamed Morsi goes, Dalia Ziada, what in your mind is next? People are upset with the Muslim Brotherhood, but is it the case that somebody like Mohamed Morsi at least represents stability at a tumultuous time?
The people are not just protesting because they are upset with Mohamed Morsi, but because they think that the Muslim Brotherhood acted as a big rock in our way to democracy. The same thing happened with the military last year when they were not good enough in running state affairs and they failed in doing politics in the country. Thus, the people went out and said, no, we don't want you anymore. We want presidential elections to have a civilian president. This led to having a President Morsi, and there were no constitutions, there were no institutions to protect us against any abuse of power, and thus he abused his powers over the past year, and he was working for the interest of his group, the Muslim Brotherhood group, not for the interests of the whole Egypt.
Dalia Ziada, stay there if you would, because I want to turn to Michael Wahid Hanna, senior fellow at the Century Foundation. You heard what Dalia was saying on the ground in Cairo. It's probably nothing new to you. But we also heard tape of Mohamed Morsi trying to make amends. Does that go anywhere at this point? Does sort of a politician's apology go over in Egypt at this point?
The speech from last week was not particularly successful. It came very late. What was offered was, in a sense, airy promises of reconciliation and dialogue without any type of real substance to what was being said. In fact, in many ways, much of the speech, I think, aggravated the political scene prior to the protests and ensured that they would be massive. I think it helped to bring turnout to the streets.
Is there an institutional remedy to this other than mass protests in the streets demanding, as Dalia said, to unelect Mohamed Morsi? Is there any other method by which they can get that, a constitutional method, trying to get a sense of what the people who are dissatisfied can actually do if Morsi refuses to go?
Well, I think there's two possibilities. One is simple resignation in the face of perhaps an ungovernable country and mass protest and essentially non-cooperation and insurrection within institutions of the state. His rule might not be sustainable. So resignation obviously is an option at any moment. The other constitutional option, I think, is Article 150, which provides the president with the power to call for referenda on issues of supreme national interest. One could imagine a scenario, and this obviously wouldn't be voluntary in the full sense,
right?
But a scenario whereby a referendum is called on the continuation of Mohamed Morsi's presidency.
So he could do that?
He could. Obviously, there would have to be a push in regard to that being called. The protest movement, to the extent that we can call it a sort of coherent thing, is pushing for early presidential elections. That's a slightly dicier proposition in terms of its legal grounding, unless Mohamed Morsi decides to resign.
John Kerry is in the Middle East, has been in Israel. We haven't heard too much from the Secretary of State. What does the United States want here from this situation? Do they even know?
Well, they don't know. Throughout this transition, what has been most important is getting to the end of transition and seeing the situation stabilize. And I think the United States has at times misjudged the political dynamics at play in the country, and I think are probably taken aback by the size of this opposition to Morsi. For a long time, the U.S. has assumed that this was the pathway to stability, that the Muslim Brotherhood represented political equilibrium in the sense of the sort of dominant political force in the country, and this was the one coherent group that could bring stability to Egypt. And I think that's a mistake.
Dalia Ziada, back into the streets today for you?
Yes, of course. And democratically speaking, he should listen to the people as long as democracy is the rule of the people.
In Cairo, Dalia Ziada, Egyptian blogger and activist. And here in studio, Michael Wahid Hanna, senior fellow at the Century Foundation. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And back here in the U.S., residents and officials are reeling from the biggest loss of life due to a wildfire in 30 years. At least 19 firefighters died this weekend battling a wildfire in the central Arizona town of Yarnell, about 80 miles northwest of Phoenix. The fire started on Friday and spread rapidly among the high heat, low humidity, and strong winds. Joining us is Fernanda Santos, reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Hi, Fernanda.
Hi, Todd.
Give us the latest, if you would, from the ground there amid the heat and dry conditions.
It is incredibly hot and very dry here. Many residents were evacuated from the town of Yarnell, and they had been told by firefighters that they had 3 hours to leave their homes. All of a sudden, the wind shifted. The flames that were moving away from the town started coming their way, and people started literally screaming on the streets, "You have to get out, you have to get out." And they left with what they could. A woman left with her parrot and her cat. The other man left with his prized antique car. And they just were at a restaurant some miles away watching the town burn, essentially.
What do we know about the conditions that caused the death of so many first responders battling this blaze?
The interesting thing about hotshots is that they are the guys who essentially are the frontline soldiers on a wildfire. One of their main jobs is to build trenches around the flames to keep the flames from spreading. So it's unclear whether the wind turned on them as well and they found themselves trapped in the fire, or whether there was some kind of error in calculating how close they could get to the flames.
Fernanda Santos is reporter for our partner, The New York Times, covering the devastating wildfire in Yarnell, Arizona. And with extreme heat hitting parts of the United States, we want to know how hot it's gotten where you live and how are you coping? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Stay with us. Well, the heat is boiling across the country. Are you ready for your blood to boil a little bit? It's time to talk about CEO pay on Wall Street and in corporate boardrooms across America. Now, over the last few years, shareholders have tried to slow the growth in executive pay, asking corporate boards to tie CEO raises to long-term goals, not just short-term results. But a recent survey conducted for our partner, The New York Times, finds that CEO pay is still climbing for CEOs at companies with at least $1 billion in revenue. The median pay package in 2012 came in at $15.1 million. That's a 16% increase just from 2011. Gretchen Morgenson has been following this story for our partner, The New York Times, where she's assistant business and financial editor. Hi, Gretchen.
Hey, Todd. How are you?
I'm fine, except wasn't the Dodd-Frank financial reform bill supposed to give shareholders more clout in reining this in? What's going on?
Well, you know, there are a couple of problems. Really, from a 30,000-foot level, the amount of pay that these people receive just keeps, as you pointed out, climbing and climbing. And there doesn't seem to be any mechanism in the boardroom to get shareholders' views on this known. And so you have a sort of a group inside the walls, as it were, the insiders making decisions for the CEOs, the top five named officials at these companies. And it does sort of feel like it's, you know, the insiders against the rest of us.
Weren't shareholders supposed to have more ability to vet CEO pay in their votes, or that under Dodd-Frank that these things had to come to votes? Is it that that's happening and the boardroom is just ignoring it?
No. What is happening, you're right, that they do have the opportunity to vote on packages. It's called the Say on Pay rules. And what happens is every year or every 1 to 3 years, shareholders are allowed to vote to say, do they approve or do they disapprove of the pay practices of the company? Well, initially there were a few companies that received a thumbs down from their shareholders, but it really has become sort of a rubber stamp even among those mutual fund companies and pension funds that really hold America's stock for you and me and the rest of us. So it's a very disappointing outcome of something that was supposed to give shareholders a little bit of oversight.
So we're talking about cash, of course, but also we all know that a golden pay package for CEOs and other executives isn't just about cash. It's also about stock options that pay off later.
Correct. The lion's share of most of these packages, Todd, is stock grants, whether that's options or outright shares that are given. And, you know, they do vest over time in many cases. So it's a period of perhaps 5 years that you get this. But at the moment, you know, when you're granted those things, they have a very high value and it can go up or down. But here is the problem that I think has not been addressed. And that is that a lot of companies use benchmarks with which they judge the company's performance and the CEO's performance. But unfortunately, some of those benchmarks are pretty easy to clear as far as hurdles are concerned. So if the stock price goes up, you have CEOs who are awarded for just getting the stock price up. Now, you might say, okay, that's a good thing because it means shareholders made more money. But there are far better benchmarks that could be used to really show whether or not the CEO is managing the company for the long-term interests of the shareholders.
Well, Wall Street is famous, even in American sort of popular culture, for focusing on quarter to quarter and not the long haul. And is this just another example that sort of makes that true, just another symptom of rewarding CEOs for the bottom line each quarter and not for long-term innovation?
Absolutely. You are dead right about that. This is another really bad example of short-termism, as it's called. And so I would lay it at the feet of the big investment companies who manage, you know, every American's money. I would say to the Fidelities, the Vanguards, all of those mutual fund companies, why aren't you holding these people accountable? And that really is where a dysfunctional aspect of this whole, you know, circular pay package reward system, that's where the dysfunction lies.
Read Gretchen Morgenson's report in the New York Times. You will see reports of CEOs making more money as their companies make money. You'll also see a couple of examples of CEOs pulling in tens of millions while their companies are losing value. And that's pretty striking. Gretchen Morgenson, assistant business and financial editor for our partner, the New York Times. Thanks, Gretchen.
Thank you, Todd.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. And before John left for Africa, he sat down to reflect on the sentiments of South Africans as they prepare for the passing of one of history's greatest leaders and peace activists. And he spoke with Dennis Goldberg, who was co-defendant with Nelson Mandela at the Rivonia trial in the Pretoria Supreme Court in 1963.
What I experienced with Nelson Mandela after prison was to say that he does what I do when you tell prison stories. You tell the story and you end it with a little wry twist so that your audience isn't left with a sense of defeat. It's like sweet and sour in cooking. You have to leave people hopeful. But I said to him, you meet the press constantly and so you can afford to get a laugh out of it. And I was pleased in his inaugural speech when he accepted the presidency. And he said with a very firm voice, something like, never, never, and never again will we allow one group to dominate over another as in the past. And I felt vindicated because there was the firmness and the determination that I hoped to hear him say, as well as his tremendous effort at reconciliation, of trying from the beginning to remember the past, but to try and build something new. Our policy from way in the 1940s was South Africa belongs to all who live in it, black and white together, and he set about trying to achieve that. And that's equally remarkable. Anger is permitted, but not bitterness, because bitterness eats you from inside, and we cannot allow the oppressor to win from beyond the grave.
It's amazing how you say that anger that he would express sometimes at his oppressors became, when he was a leader, this clarity about there shall be no domination.
Absolutely.
Leave them hopeful.
Make place for people. In fact, the policy of the African National Congress in all the years of the struggle was unity in action. Let's not look for the differences. Let's look for what we share in common to put an end to that awful regime of brutality and denial of dignity and humanity. And this became so much part of his life that a man who was born into submission could rise above that as though he was born to be president. Where did he get it from? It can only come from an inner conviction and strength and commitment and commitment. And the prize is freedom, not recognition, not adulation. And for me, one of the greatest attributes of Nelson Mandela and Oliver Tambo in particular was that they were never overwhelmed by the adulation, never became spoiled by it, became even more steadfast in their aims and determination. I'll be very sad one day. But you know, people age, situations change. He resigned the presidency. Well, he came to the end of his first term. He could have had a second term of 5 years. And he said he'd done his stint. It's a task now for young people with new attitudes. And he stepped down because holding power was not the object. The object was change and transformation. I wish politicians could have that kind of sense of destiny and commitment. But situations change, and some are power hungry, and some want to serve, and some have a mixture of both, I suppose.
Dennis Goldberg was a co-defendant with Nelson Mandela at the Rivonia trial in the Pretoria Supreme Court in 1963, and a lifelong friend of Mandela's. He spoke there with John Hockenberry. Welcome back to The Takeaway. Todd Zwillick with you, filling in for John Hockenberry today. Well, in Austin, Texas today, lawmakers convene in a special legislative session to take up Senate Bill 5. You've heard of it. That's the bill that would restrict access to abortion in Texas, banning abortions after 20 weeks of pregnancy, and tightening restrictions on abortion clinics in that state in such a fashion that would cause most of them to close. SB 5 was stalled last week when Senator Wendy Davis spent nearly 11 hours filibustering to block its passage. Listen.
Senate Bill 5 would prohibit an abortion past 20 weeks of gestation, and that gestational age itself, there's some argument about the way it's defined in the bill.
Of course, Davis became a celebrity for that performance, but Governor Rick Perry announced he wasn't giving up the fight just yet or at all. Speaking at the National Right to Life conference on Thursday, Governor Perry went so far as to say that a pro-life lesson can be learned from Senator Davis herself.
Even the woman who filibustered the Senate the other day was born into difficult circumstances. She was the daughter of a single woman. She was a teenage mother herself. She managed to eventually graduate from Harvard Law School and serve in the Texas Senate. It's just unfortunate that she hasn't learned from her own example that every life must be given a chance to realize its full potential and that every life matters.
With us is Erica Greeter, senior editor at Texas Monthly in Austin. Hi, Erica.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. Erica, so much of the coverage of this story since Wendy Davis made her filibuster attempt has sort of boiled down to Davis versus Perry in a battle of personalities. There's a detail that's getting lost here. 60% of Texans support Rick Perry on this.
Well, the polling shows that about 62% of Texans support the idea of banning abortions after 20 weeks. And I think what's gotten a little bit lost is that that provision was actually added to SB 5 after the first round. So the first round provisions of the bill were actually about the abortion clinics themselves. And I think that's where the argument that it's going, that it would effectively ban abortions altogether for millions of women in the state was coming from. Because you think about how big this state is. So if somebody's in El Paso, they might be looking at a situation where the nearest abortion clinic is in San Antonio, which is 600 miles away. And that's not necessarily in range for a lot of women, especially in the state's rural and poor areas.
Well, part of the question is, as the rest of the country kind of drills down on a political fight that has a former presidential candidate that could lead to political aspirations for Wendy Davis, the fact is a lot of Texans aren't. This bill is not as controversial in Texas as it is maybe in other places.
Well, I think it's certainly, in all the years I've covered the ledge, the only time I've seen hundreds, if not thousands, of protesters gathered like we saw on Tuesday during the filibuster itself. I mean, this is not a state that's known for an abundance of civic engagement, if I can put it that way. So certainly it's caught a lot of attention. And I think part of the issue, too, is that because the bill was sort of rushed through, or they tried to rush it through in the first special, people had a sense of not being heard and of the process not being respected. So I think in this session, it's going to be really important to see how things are handled and whether people feel like the process itself is fair. And if it is,
Senate Republicans will be better organized this time than they were during the antics of last week. Is this just going to rubber stamp and go through this week?
Probably not this week. They couldn't really be more poorly organized than they were last time. So it has good odds of getting through, but they'll want to, I think, be a little more thoughtful about it.
So they can't do it in just one session, in other words? It's going to take some more debate?
Well, I think that because a lot of them are out of town right now in the House and in the Senate, I think that they probably won't start debating it until about next week.
Okay.
In the Senate itself, we need to see if they're going to use the two-thirds rule, which you might have heard about.
Right. So SB 5, the controversial abortion bill, hits the floor in the Texas Senate in Austin. It's back. Erica Greeter, senior editor at Texas Monthly from Austin. Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. As the U.S. Army begins its withdrawal from Afghanistan, its priorities are shifting away from a focus on counterinsurgency to a range of new tactics used to protect America's interests abroad. The 82nd Airborne is the Army's rapid response force for global crisis. And for them, new priorities mean a return to an old mission. A mission that held for four decades prior to September 11, 2001, from the invasion of Normandy to Haiti, Bosnia, Kosovo in the 90s, the 82nd has a long history of jumping into crisis. Last week, we spoke with Major General John W. Nicholson, Jr., commander of the 82nd Airborne Division, about the distinct history of the paratroopers and how that division prepares for potential conflicts on the horizon.
On the shoulders of giants who preceded us. And of course, the 82nd's been at the tip of the spear for our country for many, many years.
And they were in Iraq, of course, in heavy combat roles, paratroopers yes. All over Iraq and Afghanistan. But the mission of the 82nd is changing.
Well, you're absolutely right, Todd. We have focused the last 12 years, really, on the counterinsurgency campaigns in Iraq and Afghanistan, understandably. But during those wars, our focus was on counterinsurgency in two countries against insurgents and terrorists who had a limited range of capabilities, even though they're very cunning and lethal. And now, as we look beyond Afghanistan, we're looking across the globe at a range of hybrid threats where our opponents might have a range of capabilities. So we are training on those tasks with our joint partners from the Air Force in particular, and also with our multinational partners as we look to the future and the potential for employment. These aren't just combat tasks, although we're prepared for those at the high end of the spectrum. We're also prepared to do disaster relief, humanitarian assistance, peace support operations, And so, yes, it is it's a new focus for us since we returned from Afghanistan last September.
You mentioned a wide range of tasks at the 82nd that the paratroopers are participating in. One of them is the handling of chemical weapons. Now, the world is paying attention to Syria, of course, but this is a concern in other places besides Syria, I'm sure. Can you talk about how the 82nd is training to handle chemical weapons, even as we look towards the war in Syria and what could happen with chemical weapons there?
Yeah, chemical weapons are just one of the possible conditions we could encounter in some of the hot spots around the globe. You mentioned Syria. Of course, Libya had some chemical weapons, and North Korea as well. But there are other countries around the globe that possess these weapons. So as part of our refocus from counterinsurgency to a broader range of tasks, we are training on all of the potential conditions that we can encounter. So beyond chemical weapons, this would include air defense systems, long-range artillery, mechanized or armored types of units. Again, things that we haven't faced in the last 12 years of war.
Are you able to give us, in a general sense, how confident Americans can be, whether it's the paratroopers or not, how confident Americans can be that as they worry about chemical weapons being loosed in Syria, if the regime of Bashar al-Assad falls, people are worried about what will happen with those weapons. How confident can Americans be from your point of view that they'll remain under lock and key, as it were?
Well, Todd, now we're getting into a policy discussion. Of course, we don't make policy. We implement it. But what we want to offer to the nation and to the president is our options and capabilities. And so, and if the president chose to embark upon a policy that had to do with securing those, then we want to be ready for any mission that may come our way. And the act of jumping out of a perfectly good airplane is performed by special individuals who are ready to jump, fight, and win for their nation. And the core characteristics of American paratroopers have not changed since the Second World War. Next year will be the 70th anniversary of D-Day and Market Garden. And, of course, since Normandy and since the Second World War, the 82nd's been employed in a number of other important missions of strategic importance for the nation, where the rapid responsiveness of the division and the ability to assure access by jumping in, by what we call forcible entry, airborne forcible entry, if required, that capability has been called upon numerous times, you know, since the Second World War.
Sure. Can you clarify a little bit for people like me exactly what the term forcible entry really means to someone like you?
Sure. So many of our potential opponents around the world who may threaten our interests will try to deny us access to their areas, and they would do this with air defense weapons or other chemical weapons or other types of weapons that are intended to deter or prevent us from going to an area where interests are threatened and securing our interests. So forcible entry is the term we use in military parlance to overcome an anti-access strategy. In the case of airborne forcible entry, what that means is working closely with our Air Force partners, we can deliver American paratroopers to any spot on the globe that we can fly over to perform whatever task the nation gives us to perform. And it may be something like disaster relief, so it doesn't necessarily mean combat. But at the high end of the spectrum, it could mean jumping in somewhere to protect American lives or interests anywhere around the globe.
As the 82nd did in Bosnia and Kosovo and Afghanistan and Iraq recently, and as you mentioned, Commander, those conflicts have changed, and counterinsurgency is not really what paratroopers and indeed the military is probably going to be doing a lot of in the near future. But you've said that you're ready with 20,000 paratroopers to protect America's national interest, and that sort of goes without saying. But where does that protection lay today? Where is that national interest as far as you're concerned and where paratroopers might go?
Well, we're ready to deploy literally within hours or days as required and as determined by the president. So we track on a weekly basis all of the hot spots around the globe. And, of course, most of these would be in the headlines. And this is one of the things that's different from the last 12 years of war, where we've generally known had a fairly high level of understanding of the areas that we were going to be employed into. And even though the fights are extremely difficult and hazardous for our armed forces, We knew when we were going, when we were coming back, where we were going to go, and generally what we were going to be asked to do. So that's a more predictable form of warfare than what I'm talking about going into the future with the 82nd Airborne.
Indeed. Well, Commander, you mentioned the 70th anniversary of the invasion of Europe in World War II. And I got to ask you before we let you go, Commander, when was the last time you jumped?
Oh, just jumped a couple weeks ago on an exercise with the Air Force called the Joint Forcible Entry Vulnerability Exercise, where with our Air Force partners, we practiced defeating an enemy integrated air defense system and flew in with 24 aircraft and delivered our command posts into an exercise area. It was a very good exercise.
Well, I know you take no credit away from your paratroopers, Commander, but it's interesting to know that you're jumping right along with them. Major General John W. Nicholson is their commander from Fort Bragg in North Carolina. Commander, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Todd.
We live in hard and stirring times, too sad for mirth, too rough for rhymes, for songs of peace have lost their chimes, and that's what's the matter.
Often described as the tide that turned the war, the Battle of Gettysburg stands as one of the most pivotal moments in our nation's history, and it began 150 years ago today. Dressed in Union blue and Confederate gray, 11,000 reenactors descended on Gettysburg yesterday to reenact Pickett's Charge, a major turning point in this crucial battle. A crowd of 10,000 watched as Union reenactors fought off a Southern attack and eventually forced the rebels into retreat. Jeff Nilsen is an historian and director of archives for the Saturday Evening Post. The magazine sent reporters to cover the Battle of Gettysburg back in 1863, and it's one of the few publications that covered the Civil War and is still around covering news today. Jeff says that Gettysburg stands as the bloodiest battle in the history of the Western Hemisphere, a strategic move by General Robert E. Lee.
To know why this battle took place is important to recognize the ferocity of the fighting. At the time, Robert E. Lee did not believe he could militarily conquer the North. He believed that he could discourage the North out of the war. He had beat the Union Army repeatedly and now was coming north to, he hoped, beat it decisively in the plains of South Central Pennsylvania. If he could accomplish that, he believed that there would the anti-war sentiment in the North would grow so great that the North would have no other choice except to start negotiating with the South for a peace and a separation. On the other hand, the Union came into this battle recognizing that Lee had defeated them time and time again. They had never won a decisive victory in 2 years of fighting, and morale in the North was running very low. And there was a determination among the Union soldiers to really make this one count. There are accounts from soldiers' letters coming into the battle telling their wives and their family, we know this is the decisive battle. We know this is going to determine the outcome. And they were right in that regard.
And from what you know from letters, can you take us inside the mind maybe of the average Union soldier? Fighting to end slavery? Probably not.
Some were. Some actually had taken that cause to heart. But many of them had joined in the first flush of patriotic fervor, and they thought that war was a way to get a name for themselves, to get a job, earn money, to get off the farm and away from their family for a while and have some adventure. So that was a big attraction. Also, they saw the Confederacy as traitors who had to be put down. That was a stronger sentiment than the liberation of slaves. Though there was the recognition in the Union that ultimately this is a fight about slavery. Because we know this, because it's been studied, I can give you a profile, at least of the Union soldier. Coming into the battle, the average Union soldier was 25 years old. He was 5 feet 8 inches, weighed 140 pounds. He was born in this country. He was he worked on a farm, and he was single. And his chances of becoming a casualty in this coming fight was 1 in 4.
In the Battle of Gettysburg.
In the Battle of Gettysburg.
Now, what about a composite of the average Confederate soldier, to the best that you can?
Well, the Confederate soldier was fighting for states' rights. That was definitely very clear in his mind, though what states' rights meant to him was going to be different than what it meant to the legislators in, say, Mississippi or Virginia. But they were very determined to be independent of the United States, and they were going to fight whoever was put in their way to earn what they considered their freedom from the United States government. It's harder to tell the profile of the Confederate soldier. The record keeping wasn't as efficient and as thorough. A lot of soldiers just signed up and went off to the war, and there wasn't a lot of paperwork that accompanied them. We can assume, though, that they were rather similar to the average Union soldier, though they probably would have had a greater variation in age and certainly would not have been as healthy or well-fed coming into this battle or as well cared for, because the Confederacy had been fighting an uphill battle against reduced supplies for at least a year and a half.
And let's just be clear, because it probably bears remembering, in this era of modern warfare and drones and remote sensors and artillery that can fire 50 miles, this battle really was hand-to-hand.
That's right. The artillery, of course, wasn't seeing the people that they were killing. You could see that far out in the field, but it wasn't personal. For the infantry, though, the attacks of the Confederacy against the Union line, it was very much face-to-face. You saw who you were shooting. Sometimes you hit them, sometimes you didn't, depended how well you could shoot with a musket. But when the firing began, usually in whole lines of soldiers, great holes would open up in the attacking lines of the enemy. And you would see these men go down in huge numbers and lay there waiting for help or maybe beyond help. Then the next line would come up and you'd be firing again and they would get closer. And the amazing thing in all this fighting was how closely matched the two sides were and how often the Confederacy broke the Union line, pushed them back, and Union reinforcements came in just at the last minute to repair the line and push the Confederates back. It happened again and again and again, and most particularly on July 3rd at the peak of what is known as Pickett's Charge.
Jeff Nielsen, historian and director of the archives at Saturday Evening Post. Of course, we can't leave this discussion without touching on the Gettysburg Address. President Lincoln just a couple of years later, and we all know about the address in 47 years ago, but I wonder if American history and Americans would have as strong a view or even be aware of the Battle of Gettysburg as they are today if it hadn't been for the posthumous speech that Lincoln decided to give there a couple of years later. If that hadn't happened, would we be having this discussion today, do you think?
I don't think so. And when people have discussed Gettysburg with me, inevitably the address comes up, even though it occurred in November, not in July. It's interesting to note that the Gettysburg Address was the commemoration of a cemetery that was built in the town, because thousands and thousands of casualties still littered the field far beyond the capability of any townspeople to bury them. So many of the bodies lay out there for days or weeks, and making the area almost uninhabitable. So the decision to build a commemorative cemetery was a matter of necessity, but also it was, for Lincoln, a way to memorialize these deaths and also the general cause, and to explain to Americans why they had fought and what sense it made for this great slaughter of men to have happened.
Jeff Nielsen is historian and director of archives for the Saturday Evening Post. The Saturday Evening Post reported directly on the Battle of Gettysburg, with just a handful of other publications that are still around today. Jeff Nielsen, thank you.
Thanks very much. You can find more information at our website, SaturdayEveningPost.com.
And we will. All this hour, we've been talking about the extreme hot weather that has hit the United States and asking you how hot it's gotten where you are and how are you coping. Ashley in Las Vegas texted us to say this: it's 116 degrees and I work in an even hotter kitchen. I just dream of the beach and the lake. And finally, from Miami, Florida, it's hot as hell, but eating spicy food. Chilies lower your body temperature. There's a tip. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or find us at thetakeaway.org.
And be sure to follow us for all the latest on developments in Africa. We'd also love to hear your story of how world events or anything disrupted your exotic vacation, especially as we shout out once again to all of our new listeners.
That's right, John. We want to welcome our new friends today in Minnesota, San Francisco, Hawaii, San Antonio, and Tampa. I'm Todd Zwillick here in New York.
And I'm John Hockenberry in Southern Africa. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.